I'll just begin recording. Hi, this is Paul, and I have a very special guest today. This is, now help me pronounce your last name. It's Thomas Steininger?
Steininger.
Steininger. Perfect. Yes. And Thomas is one of the other speakers at the Breakwater Festival that we are going to be having in Germany at the end of October. And Matthias has set this up so that we could get a chance to know each other. And we're going to do another conversation on his channel. And then we're going to do another conversation with all the speakers. So we're this is our first sort of getting to know each other and really an introduction for my channel of Thomas's work and what he's up to. And then, of course, he can ask any questions of me. So I do this often on my channel where I'm a pastor. And so I'm used to just interviewing people and finding out about their lives and why they do what they do and what their concerns are and what their joys are. So I'm just going to lead in. Tell me a little bit about where you were born and your family of origin.
I'm born in Austria.
Okay.
I live in Germany now, but I'm Austrian. And I'm born into a Catholic context. In Austria, and I studied there philosophy, and then also soon left Austria first for Germany. Then I lived it some time in the US and in other countries. And since I think 15 years or so, I'm back in Europe, but not in Austria anymore, but in Frankfurt in the middle of Europe.
So you grew up in a Catholic context. Did you grow up? How often would you go to church? Were your parents everyday Mass people, or once a week, or festivals, or what was the relationship of, let's say, the Catholic Church in your formation?
You're asking this question because in a different context, I just realized the church that I grew up in, which was a modern church, was built in the 1950s. There's a very prominent altar image, 20 meters high.
Wow.
And I realized that basically every week until my 16th year, I saw this image. I basically grew up with this image. I still know it by heart. And in a way, so every week we went to church, and to give you more of the religious context, my high school, I was in a Jesuit high school, so I had some Jesuit education before I then went to university and studied philosophy.
And what were your thoughts as a child about the religious participation of your family? Was it just something assumed in your life? What impact did it have on you?
I mean, two things. It just was what life is, period. Sunday you have breakfast, your father is still at home. In fact, on Sunday, the father makes the breakfast, which is unusual. We have classical music on Sunday, and then you go to church.
Okay.
And on the other hand, that's maybe also not worthy. I appreciate going to church. There was something. Still, when I think about it, I felt uplifted by something. Let's put it that way. It was not again, oh, I have to go to church thing. I mean, it also was that. The memory, particularly when you look back, was there was something that I still appreciate that it was part of my life.
Okay. Now, when you went to university, did church going drop off for you, or did you continue to go to church when you went to university?
The short version is instead of becoming a Jesuit, I became Marxist.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Well, talk to me about that.
it's in some way very simple. This social justice theme got me and was very important to me. And in that sense, I was very much in the context. It was in the 1980s, where kind of the new ecological green movement, also kind of against nuclear energy and things like that, was very prominent, and it had a kind of a Marxist flavor to it, and I was part of that in university.
Where did you go to university?
In Vienna.
Oh, Vienna, okay.
Austria. But then, and that's maybe also interesting for you then, my thesis in philosophy is quite funny, because in fact the motive of it, because in some way I was fed up with this leftist context, and to put it in simple words, with the power games in them. And I did a lot of psychotherapy, and something opened up to me, which again was something that I would now call spiritual experiences. And my thesis that I called, if you translate it in English, something like self-reliance and the development of society, was a critique of alienation, of the Marxist understanding of alienation. And I used something which I'm still proud of, because I think it's true. It's the first academic work, I think, in German-speaking countries that use Ken Wilber, and with a very odd combination, also Martin Heidegger, to kind of ask the question, what is alienation about in a deeper way? So I used very much the Heideggerian sense of being in that sense, and that brought me to different directions and a leftist kind of university Marxist time behind.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So you absorbed the Marxism stuff, but then you began to even deconstruct the Marxism stuff and said they've got this concept of alienation that's just sort of an assumed thing. Well, what's really going on there? And so you use some Ken Wilber and some Heidegger, and what did you discover? What were some of your thoughts?
I mean, the very simple thing, and that's the where the spiritual life catches up again, that alienation is deeper than economic alienation, that is soul alienation, that there's something going on there. Are also Siggy Jung's work and his understanding of the subconscious, in difference to the Freudian understanding of the subconscious, was important for me, and that there's something going on you have to use spiritual terms to understand what's going on here. Let's put it this way.
Very interesting. Jordan Peterson will often talk about when he would work with patients that he discovered that for many people, he had to use religious language at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there wouldn't be the kind of transformation that his patients mm-hmm. were looking for. Mm-hmm. That there's something about that register of language that is very deep, even though in a secularized society, we have tended to say, well, that's sort of a hobby, or it's something peripheral. And I hear something, I don't know if that's fair or not, but I hear something of that in what you just said to me.
Yeah, it very much so. And in fact, this is something that also became important to me in the way I sometimes talk about, and that is similar to what you're just talking about, Peterson, is that in fact every single one of us has a relationship to the sacred. Even if I hate the sacred, I know what I'm talking about. There's an existential knowing. There's no, I have no, everyone, when whatever you understand with the sacred, there's something where you have the existential relationship where the word sacred is appropriate. And it's different than having reverence or finding it meaningful. It's a different level of that. And that's a different language that uses this term that in itself, of course, is a spiritual terminology.
Interesting. So after you wrote this thesis, what did you do after university?
A couple of things. I worked for the Austrian radio. Oh. I did, in fact, radio programs about spirituality and religion. But for some time, I was also at that time in Russia because I spoke Russia and learned about the new spiritual life in that time, Yeltsin Russia. And at the same time, I did an education as a psychotherapist. So I worked then also beside the radio as a psychotherapist. And then I went to a spiritual community. In fact, in Marin County in California, which is a spiritual community that became important to me. Although everything fell apart out of usual reasons, how spiritual communities fell apart, power games and things like that. But we did something there. We did a lot of spiritual practice, a lot of meditation, and a lot of, let's say, conversations. And we had a focus that what's happening between people is as important than what's happening in my own experience. And this set a foundation of my later work that even after all this also fell apart, what I'm doing and what we are doing here in Frankfurt is a form of dialogue work that we call emergent interbeing and emergent dialogue, where we very much focus on the dialogical opening of when people are talking with each other. Let's put it that way. That's an easy way to start.
Talk to me a little bit about this community in Marin County. How did you get involved with them?
It was a spiritual teacher, and some people still know him. His name is Andrew Cohen. I met him, and I was very impressed by him, also because he was very demanding, and I enjoyed this demanding quality. And there's a lot I still honor very much, but there's also a lot that went wrong. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Did the, you know, what one of the spiritual communities are obviously very interesting to me because I'm a pastor. Yeah. And whereas in, well, really these communities have obviously popped up all throughout history. One could look at, let's say, Plato's school as a spiritual community, especially if I think John Vervaeke is correct, and many others who have looked at the work of Plato. We sort of segregated over into academic philosophy, but it was what we would probably consider something much more religious in its day. And so there have always been spiritual communities, but churches have, and for all of this sort of dismissal of organized religion, churches have been, you know, not perfect, but often very stable spiritual communities for a great many people for a lot of time. I've also had a lot of interesting conversations with people who have gotten into different spiritual communities, some of which they themselves would identify as a cult, others not. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting to me, and what you just said about the the interrelationship between people, I think, is extremely true. Mm-hmm. Because especially in a place like the United States, where churches, at least compared to Europe, seem fairly strong, a fairly high number of Americans go to church, at least compared to Europe. And yet church is, you know, church is voluntary. There's no, you know, there's you don't have a different relationship with the government or others on whether or not you go to church. And so people go to church willingly and voluntarily. The quality of the relationships between people is what really helps make spiritual communities stable. And mm-hmm. as a pastor, I very much see my job as, or one of my jobs is very much to facilitate healthy relationships between people in the church. In many ways, as a pastor, I see my primary job as trying to, you can't really create a community. You sort of facilitate, you sort of encourage, you sort of garden a community where people, in fact, do have healthy relationships between each other. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very interested in why communities begin and form. I've also been involved in church planting, which is starting new churches. Why some communities flourish, why communities collapse, or just sort of lose momentum. And there's often a lot of focus on the leader, and the leader is very important, especially in the formation of a community, because they tend to form around leaders. But very quickly, if you're going to transition from a following to a community, I think you're exactly right. And it's this quality of the relationships between people. And that, of course, then becomes the culture of the community. I don't know if any of that rings true to your experience with this. It sounds like that experience was very formative in terms of, on one hand, you had enough motivation to travel around the world to participate in something like this, and you had enough motivation to leave this, but it also had a formative influence on your life to, and it sounds like this has sort of become a lot of what your focus has been. What is the quality of the relationships we have between people, mm-hmm. and how is that quality formative for not only the people, but also the communities moving forward? Is that correct?
Very much so. I would describe it. There are three factors that I see. One is, of course, around these communities, a leader. The second that you have not touched on, although I think you're deeply immersed in, is tradition.
Yes.
Which basically there is something that's also developed through time and over generations, and that has its own life form and is not just tapping into something, particularly when you build a tradition. Not every cult becomes a tradition, but if it becomes a tradition. And the third is communion. And the way I understand it, all three elements, at least from my perspective, of what is the attractor, is the meeting in the sacred. That what makes a spiritual community is that I meet with you in something that I acknowledge also being sacred. Being in a tradition, being a religious or spiritual tradition is because somehow this tradition represents for me something that I feel is related to the sacred. And being with a charismatic leader, for example, is because he or she holds something that connects me. But the connector in all of three is the way I see it, the search for the sacred.
I think that's right. I think that's right. So So you began working on this this dialogical work, this emergent dialogue. Tell me a little bit more about that. How did you come up with this? What have you learned from this? Has this sort of become the focus of your work?
That is the focus of our work here. And the way to describe it, and that's something that connects me very much also with John Bebeke. That's why I really feel John being a friend, and I feel very connected to his attempt, what he tries to do, and what he tries to do from dialectic to dialogos. I feel very much related to that. And one, and this is more a philosophical understanding of this work, but it's important to me, and it has to do with an historic understanding of the development of consciousness. That when most of the high religions were formed in the so-called Axial Ages, this was also one of the high points of the individuation process of us as humanity. It was kind of the first time where we kind of left some kind of tribal context behind and created something where this is particularly true in the Western context, I as an individual have a personal relationship to the absolute called God. So that there's something in the Abrahamic traditions where this I-thou relationship is very prominent in the relationship to the sacred. And it has very much to do that we were, as a humanity, developing to creating an I-sense. I think all of our Western culture, and I think that it's the virtue of the Western culture to really have a highly individuated capacity of personal responsibility, because without individuality, you have no personal responsibility. But part of the trouble of our time is also that this development kind of developed its own shadow, like everything has its own shadow. And this is kind of the, you could name the narcissistic tendencies of our time, this self-relatedness, where it's very difficult to see the world not self-referential. And a lot of kind of new age spirituality and a lot of psychotherapeutic culture is very much about the self-referential frame that in one hand is important, but you also can get lost in that. And what happens right now, that's my interpretation, it pops up in different places, and the dialogous work of John is part of it, and what we are doing is part of it. There is a new interest in relatedness, in we spaces. There's something where, in my world, when there is a journey from pre-individuation to individuation to something maybe trans-individuation, where our embeddedness in relatedness is more important than my self-reference. And to see that when we come together, we don't just meet in this personal sense, we also meet in something that is beyond that, that is universal, is a deep experience that is a deep spiritual experience, but I think it's also culturally important because it liberates us from this self-reference that our narcissistic culture is so much embedded in.
Very interesting. It's very interesting, this evolutionary process that you're seeing here. And I think part of what we're seeing as we're continuing to watch, let's say, the recession of modernity, mm-hmm. in which individualism sort of reached its peak. I mean, there's a strong relationships between modernity and individualism, and I think with John Vervaeke and his identification of the meaning crisis, it's clear that a lot of the symptomology of the meaning crisis has to do with this shadow side of individualism, mm-hmm. that people find themselves, all the way back to your thesis on Marx, your deconstruction of Marx, people find themselves alienated, not necessarily alienated from the means of production or alienated from these economic aspects, but alienated from others, alienated. Mm-hmm. Studies today show that in the developed world, especially in places like the United States, people are now living, there are more and more single person households than mm-hmm. ever before. Divorce rates continue to be high. Marriage rates are lower and lower. And you know, all of this leads us to suspect that something like an epidemic of narcissism mm-hmm. is disabling people to have a capacity for community, basically. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a complaint in the culture that, oh, people need community. Fair, they do. There's a realization for that. But I think there's less of a realization that we have a capacity for community that needs to be developed in us. And probably the only way to develop that is within the practice of community and the maintenance of community. In other words, thinking of our capacity for relationships as something analogous to, let's say, muscular strength, that it is something that needs to be built in time and it needs to be durable. And whereas in past generations, scarcity, danger, a whole variety of things that if we had to choose, we would not like, forced us to develop these capacities for community. Now, with affluence, security, many of the fruits of modernity, some of this capacity for community has atrophied in people. And now we discover that, you know, maybe not unlike, let's say, cardiovascular health, that was simply a function of a pre-modern society where you're mm-hmm. walking everywhere and animal and physical strength, we're always using our bodies. Our community muscles have atrophied, perhaps in the same way that our physical muscles have atrophied, because mm-hmm. we no longer live in a context that actually demands it of us. And let's say in pre-modern societies, people were forced to develop their capacity for community, whereas now, well, if you don't develop a capacity for relationality and community, maybe you'll have the money and the means to live without it, but you will suffer for that, and you will suffer from its deprivation. Is that, you know, when I listen to you talk, that I'm just trying to sort of line things up in terms of some of the thinking that I've been doing lately with respect to some of these issues?
No, I very much can relate to that. And I do have a question also for you as a pastor in that, because it seems to me that it is also important when we talk about community, that we talk about community in what? Because I think part of our secular culture, and I think this is not really acknowledged enough, individualism, in the worst case, narcissism, is the only thing that's really in the end sacred to me. I can meet you in community just in a transactional way, really. Because I love you because I love you.
Right.
That's in the end, it's always self-referential, and maybe right. it's a form of communion, but it's a kind of a strange communion, because basically it's about I'm here because I want da da da. There's another communion, and that's basically what religious communities stand for, where we are together in communion with something that transcends us. That does not have to be the Abrahamic God in that sense, but something, some transcendence, and that changes the quality of communion in a very different way. We really can be together in something, because otherwise, you're always somehow with me, and I think it's important to honor that. Maybe it's the transition from community to communion. I don't know. Maybe that's the right word to use that. But it's helpful to highlight that, because that allows us also to look for community in a deeper sense than we usually do, which is not transactional, but being something that is deeply important for us, to not, again, use the word sacred for us.
I think that's very true. I see two areas of that in American culture right now. One is in the marriage crisis, that people are going into romantic relationships, and marriage has sort of been seen as a marriage is supposed to be about me. When my wife and I just celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary. And one thing that I think I've learned over the years is that marriage can't be about me. It has to be about us. It has to be about our family. It has to be about our children. Obviously began with a religious formation as well. And the other crisis in America right now is, while in fact, historically, American church attendance has been, you know, quite high in comparison to Europe, those numbers are declining. And so church leaders are some are in panic mode, others are in anxiety over this. And I think you stated it quite well, that the church has to be about something else. People, as a pastor, if someone who hasn't been attending church or maybe has never attended church comes into a church, it usually begins in a personal crisis. Maybe they had a fight with their spouse. Maybe they're depressed. Maybe they lost a job. Maybe they're drinking too much and realize they need something. And so that'll spark them to say, go into the door of a church. And the initial impetus is, I need something for me. Mm-hmm. But then, in a sense, in church language, we talk about religious consumers. Then they're entering the church as a religious consumer. And very quickly, you realize that only goes so far, because the consumer narrative is one of acquisition. It's very much having mode. Once I get from you, the romantic partner, or once I get from it, the church, what I'm looking for, which is maybe relief from my anxiety, maybe help finding a new job, maybe a little bit of assistance in dealing with alcohol or something like this. Once I get that, then I'm done with the community. Mm-hmm. And I think you're exactly right in that what holds communities together, and especially churches together, is it can't be finally about you, because part of what we do as ministers is, yes, people come to us. Yes, they come to us as consumers, but part of what the church has to help people do is, and we have all this language in church from this, is turn them from a seeker into a servant. And they have to go from a seeker into a servant of servants of others. Servants of God, you know, not just servants of their needs or their appetites or their desires or their ambitions. So, no, I think what you say is very, very right. And I think you're right in that it obviously scales far beyond just religious institutions. It has to do with nationalism and citizenship. It has to do with, I mean, people form clubs over around all sorts of things other than themselves. And it might be a sense of service to others. It might be a sense of pursuit of a high ideal. And it can be ideals around whole ranges of things. They don't necessarily have to be metaphysical or spiritual or religious, but that transition has to happen away from a narcissistic consumer self-centeredness into an other focus. And I think just generally speaking for people, that is very much part of what happens with a religious transformation or a conversion. You know, C.S. Lewis made the comment that humility is not thinking less of yourself, let's say in terms of your status, but just being less mindful of yourself. In mm-hmm. other words, now I can live, when I live for others in a community, I'm no longer self-conscious, I'm no longer self-possessed, or obsessed, or even a captive to the appetites, ambitions, or anxieties of myself. Mm-hmm. And did any of that sort of connect? That's what I heard you talking about, trying to put it in my own words.
Yes, and I would like to make a differentiation, and I'm curious what you think, because you can serve in this way, let's say in ethnic community or in a national community, and that can be a good thing if it doesn't turn into nationalism. It can be, let's say, if you make differentiation between patriotism and nationalism, it can be a good thing. But there's something about a spiritual or religious communities that at least ideally, because quite often they are also kind of identity-based, kind of my tradition, my thing, like my nation or my family. But ideally, the way I understand it, in all this attempt to lift the sacred in the different wisdom traditions of the world, it is to develop a serving relationship to the good, the true, and the beautiful. In which way you call it, and you can personify and call it God, but it's not a fixed thing. It's not kind of I'm Catholic and I stand with my Catholic beliefs and da da da. Or I'm German, Austrian, da da da, and I serve this. It needs an ongoing openness to find out together. You know, the good, the true, and beautiful. Yeah, what does this mean right now? In which situation, with whom am I right now? How does it? So basically, use the religious terminology, how does God show up? And that's different than any kind of other community that I mean, you don't have to be explicitly spiritual. Like some communities that are just very friendship, but in nature they are spiritual. In that they're spiritual because of that. But I think it's helpful to make that point, because it shows the value of religious community that I think is important in our society, because we are so radically are also missing it.
I think that's right, because we are incarnate beings. I mean, the good, the true, and the beautiful are, I think we, you know, these transcendental values, we recognize them and we seek them in all sorts of instantiations. You know, even let's say, I mean, nationalism can be an idolatry. If the nation itself becomes the greatest good, then it becomes an idol, because mm-hmm. what is good about the nation should be the good, the true, and the beautiful, which is worth serving, you know, and the nation is always sort of a proxy for, at least in religious terms, the image bearers that are around me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, in Jesus' terms, the greatest among you is the servant of all. Mm-hmm. So, no, I think that's right. A serving relationship to the good, the true, and the beautiful. But the good, the true, and the beautiful are always, we're always going to meet them We're always going to meet them in actuality. We don't meet the good as such, the true as such, and the beautiful as such. We always meet them instantiated. And for that reason, there's a breadth to all of this.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think religious communities attempt to, in some ways, get, I mean, the whole point of a religious community is to get as close to the thing itself as possible. But of course, we are temporal, material, physical beings in time and space. And so we always have to get at, you know, we always move towards, you know, the thing itself, the sacred itself, via all of these other instantiations. I mean, that's the only way we can, because of the mode of being that we're in.
And in that, I really also appreciate the concreteness of traditions, who try in the different ways. And I can see that in Buddhist context, in Shinto context, in Christian context, where in their own language, in their cultural understanding of that, they live that, and there is a body of wisdom that's developed over time. That's, at least when it goes well, it's tested through time. That allow us to do that. And that's, I think, the power of tradition. And that's, I think, why we still and always will need tradition. But there is, of course, a challenge in tradition. And the challenge that I have in mind right now is how to live this in an open society where, to use a Catholic image, there is no Pope to tell you what the true, the beautiful and the good is. Yeah. So we have to find it in openness, honoring our differences, but not doing what usually secular society does, basically denying that there is something sacred that connects us. That's an interesting bind of our time, where we are developing a world society. How can we do this as an open society, honoring all the different attempts to live the sacred, honoring our differences, and finding a mutual ground of understanding how we can do this together?
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think that's well said. All of these traditions, of course, emerged. We can't fail to recognize how, in many ways, and this isn't just contemporary, but over the last, you know, how technology very quickly stressed, let's say, individually isolated communities that had traditions that developed the sacred. And once, you know, early empires did this, bringing nations together, and then empires sort of found ways to try to, you know, to try to cohere. But since the Columbian Exchange, which has sort of continued to, globalization has continued to accelerate, now we have all of these traditions living next to one another. And whereas on one hand you can say there is no Pope, well, there still is a Pope. And both of those things are true. And I just, for example, read a Catholic friend of mine had sent me a piece written from the perspective of some traditional Catholics. Right now, part of the big war going on in Catholicism is sort of the Catholic traditionalists versus, let's say, the Catholic progressives. And beneath so much of this are the tensions of pluralism, that we do see the good, the true, and the beautiful in many traditions, but you can't really occupy, you can sort of look at many traditions and glean from them, but you can't really inhabit multiple traditions. Over the course of your life, you might sort of, you know, graze, you might be a tourist and go in and out through them, But people like to say something, well, I'm a global citizen. And it's like, yeah, but you probably only had one language of formation. And you probably only had one culture of formation. And there might have been transformations within your life that sort of moved you into different spaces. Mm-hmm. I spent, 7 years of my life as a foreign missionary. And so speaking mostly Spanish, actually working with Haitians who are speaking yet another language. And, as a young man in my 20s, I began to experience what it's like to sort of take on a new persona, take on a new name, inhabit a new culture. That was quite a bit different from my own. But there's always a sense of, I never was a Haitian. I never was a Dominican. I always was an American, but just not just an American, a Dutch Calvinist American from a particular subculture and all of these. And so the challenge, this challenge that we have been living with for centuries now of tradition, which is, well, we always must have tradition, and traditions very much bring time-tested, battle-tested truths into our lives that, if their value is going to be maintained, the tradition needs to be maintained. Mm-hmm. But traditions always continue to be tested by other traditions, by technological disruption, mm-hmm. by the normal stresses of human need and society and conflict that come to us. Mm-hmm. So no, I think you're very right. And one of the things, I first visited Europe for the first time last summer. And even though I grew up in the New York metropolitan area and now have lived in California for a long time and lived in the Caribbean for a number of years, one of the things that struck me in Europe was this tension between, it fascinated me. I flew into the Netherlands, and of course my ancestry is Dutch. And so there's a certain amount of similarity from the immigrant traditions I had to the Netherlands. And then we drove from the Netherlands to Germany. And I thought, driving from the Netherlands to Germany? You're in Germany so fast. I mean, I can drive a long, long time and stay in California and drive an even longer time and never leave the United States. And if I do, I can drive into Canada and really drive for a long time. And it's all one big monoculture with a fairly shallow tradition that is sort of borrowed from all of these other traditions underneath. And in Europe, my goodness, you both have traditions which are very deep, very well formed, and also all right next to each other, and segmented by, I was amazed when we went over from the Netherlands to Germany. I was with a Dutch national and someone else who grew up in the Netherlands. And I thought, boy, when we go to Germany, I'm with these guys. And these Dutchmen, their German isn't that good, And I was just amazed how local all of this is. And I wonder to what degree this particular history of such a relatively small land area like Western Europe, and of course, I mean, German, Austria, Germany, what to now is, I mean, the whole history of the formation of Germany, a relatively new country. I just found it fascinating where these tensions that you spoke of, I can really see how they very much become salient, because there is a sense of crisis in this. To what degree are you a European, or are you Austrian, or are you German, whatever that means, especially with, the dramatic history that this whole, that whole landmass has had over the last 150 years. I don't know. That sounded awful and terribly rambly, but that's what your thought sort of provoked in me in terms of this question of tradition and being, and how the traditions connect up with these abstract transcendentals that are moving in them.
And what you what you're getting at is how, at least the way I understand it, and how can we live this together?
Right.
Because what you're saying is particular to of Europe, a particular region, because it's obvious here. It's also similar to in other regions in the world, but it's particularly also true for the world as such. And how can we do this and respecting the traditions of the others without making a melting pot like everything that are, but honoring the otherness of the other, and at the same time find mutual ground of understanding in something that's deeply meaningful. How can we do this? And one reason why I bring this up, because this is one thing that we also try to respond to in what we're doing with our practice, which we call emergent interbeing. And interbeing is a term that I use by others. I don't know if you know the Vietnamese Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who just recently died. He's one of the most famous Buddhist teachers worldwide. He was Vietnamese, but lived in France. He coined this term. We use it not from his tradition, but I'm very inspired the way he did. He did also something other, which I find very telling and relevant for this context. He was speaking about the next Sangha, which is a Buddhist term for community. The next Buddha is a Sangha.
Oh, interesting.
He really made the point, the next Buddha is a Sangha. It's not a Buddha, it's a Sangha. And not directly being connected to his work, but also inspired by that, I see there are two forms of we spaces that we're living in. And one is very much identity-based, family, tradition, me, where it's basically the we space is we Austrians, we Germans, we Westerners, something. But there's a very different we space that's very relevant for us as a global open society. That's just the we of the present. So we haven't really talked before this conversation, but there's a we space opening up between the two of us. How much I am able to allow this to be a place of mutual understanding? How much am I allowed that there's a meaning field opening up that is a shared one? That's independent if you are American or Indonesian. It's true for both forms of dialogue forms. And I need all my openness and all my also being interested and curiosity in you, and same time authenticity to me, to allow this interbeing space to form itself in a way that meaning is possible between us. That means we are having a meaningful conversation where at least to some degree there's mutual understanding. To the degree that we can do this, small or big, we can lift the multiplicity of our world. And that is something that I find very inspiring.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you find it inspiring? Because I agree, I find it inspiring too. I mean, I wouldn't be doing everything I do on my channel if I didn't find it inspiring. But it's interesting, isn't it, that we do find this inspiring. There's something in us that when we experience, because I've been doing these estuary groups, and these estuary groups are, people come to them from very different backgrounds. And it's exactly as you described, there's a we space that opens up. And in the process of, let's say, an estuary conversation, the conversation, what people are so surprised by is how the conversation, let's say, how the conversation develops something of a life of its own. And so then people recognize that they are a part of it, they've contributed to it, but no one person in the group sort of owns, we all have responsibility for it and to it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, it's not owned by anyone. It's very much between. And so what is it in us that longs for this and that enjoys this and that even sacrifices for it? We sacrifice time, we sacrifice attention, we sacrifice energy, we sacrifice money.
It's interesting because what came to my mind spontaneously very much mirrors what you just said. And the word that came to me is again a word from John Beweke, is a process of homing. Although we have not met before, to the degree that I experience that we meet, I feel that I am still me and you are still yourself, but there is something that we meet together, there is a homing. And if it's a deep homing in something sacred, it's a very deep arriving in something meaningful shared that I find very attractive, mm-hmm. where you can your otherness doesn't go away in that sense. It's part of it. But as you describing, nobody owns this. Mm-hmm. It's held by itself, mm-hmm. through a finding of this field of understanding, this interbeing field in my language, where we arrive together in, and that's very attractive.
You know, you're this statement, the next Buddha is a Sangha. That to me as a Christian is an extremely interesting statement. Mm-hmm. Because of course, you know, I think a reading of Paul in the Synoptic Gospels in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus announces the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven is near. And so that's the term that's generally used there. In the Gospel of John, you have eternal life or life of the ages is used. And Paul, in the Pauline corpus, you always have in Christ, you know, because what you meet, what is formed, and, you know, this gets into some Protestant Catholic tensions, but what Protestantism basically asserted is that, you know, the Protestants sing this little song, I am the church, you are the church, we are the church together. A church is not a building, a church is not a steeple, a church is not a resting place, the church is the people, Christ is the people. Now there's a lot of, as modernity recedes, aspects of Protestantism also recede and get renegotiated with more older sacramental traditions like the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics. But this, you know, in Christianity, obviously, where Jesus says, where two or three are gathered, I am there. And so, you know, in my tradition, there's been a long tradition of, it's that Christ is present in the community. Now, we also, with the Catholics and the Orthodox, Christ is present in the sacrament, in the body and the blood of Christ and the Eucharist, but Christ is also present in the community, and the community is the body of Christ. And the other language that we've been sort of pursuing with Jonathan Peugeot and John Verveke is also that, you know, sort of a reacquiring of the language of spirit, but hopefully not sort of in an other mode, in a sort of Cartesian dualism where we are material and spirit is other. Mm-hmm. Assuming spirit is sort of divorced as immaterial, but rather, you know, when you and I have a conversation like we're having right now, or when an estuary group meets together, and it happens, because we don't quite, there's some groups in which it doesn't seem to happen, and other mm-hmm. groups in which it really happens. There's a spirit that develops, and it is in fact emergent, in that it seems to be coming from the practice and the community and what the people are doing, but it's also from above. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the New Testament language has all of that stuff too, where it's not, when two or three are gathered and it happens, it both comes from below, but also descends from above. And you see that, for example, in Acts chapter 2 of the day of Pentecost, where they are all gathering and they're praying. And then there's the sound of a rushing wind, and there are tongues of fire. And it's sort of a recapitulation, let's say, of Christ's baptism, when the Spirit descends and a voice comes down as Jesus comes up out of the water. And I mean, it's all of this stuff sort of happening, and where suddenly we recognize that, for lack of better language, the sacred is in the room. Mm-hmm. And in Christian churches, we'll say some things like, you know, Jesus was in the room today. Whereas on one hand, on one level, we say at every worship service, Christ mm-hmm. is here, Christ is present. Mm-hmm. But there are some moments when Jesus really showed up today. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how, you know, these dynamics work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you were talking, when you also made a differentiation of emanation and emergence, I very much agree that there's something coming together that allows this emergence process. But, and then was exactly the image as you were talking, the sacred is coming down to create the wholeness of this moment. Mm-hmm. Because the sacredness of the moment is completely dependent on the moment. In different situations, it implies different things. It means the coming together in this, the sacred, that creates this emanation. And it's both directions at the same time when you feel the sacred is in the room, or to use the Christian language, Christ is in the room, which basically is saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting that it's very easy for people to relate to that. It's much more difficult to kind of find a rationale around it, what this really means. Mm-hmm. When something like this happens in the space, and the way you're describing it in your meetings, this seems to be the case often. It's also very interesting that people who had no connection to this otherwise very strongly can express the reality of this. And that sometimes using different words and different contextualizations, but when you talk, it's very obvious that you're talking about the same or the similar thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just very astounding how we obviously have the shared realization of something that, where does this exist, in this subtle reality? But it's not only that it's there, it's also important. It's very meaning giving in that. And that, put a little in a trivial way, that makes a good conversation a good conversation.
Yeah. So this started for me when I started making videos about Jordan Peterson, and part of the reason I started making videos about Jordan Peterson was I noticed that in comment sections on Reddit, there were people who, something was coming alive in people that according to their own testimonies, hadn't been happening before. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, okay, you can watch Jordan Peterson on YouTube and get excited because stuff is happening. But when the video is over and when the YouTube shuts down, and if you're still all alone in your house, then we're back to the shadow of individualism. And so So then I started, a number of people said, oh, you should start a meetup. And I thought, okay, I'm not sure exactly sure what we'll do with it. I know what to do in a church service. I know how to start a church. I know how to do all that, mm-hmm. but we'll start a meetup. And anybody who's interested in Jordan Peterson and wants to talk about it can come. And so they did. And so we sort of chewed on that for a few years. But that, in a sense, people just coming to want to talk about a celebrity that they watch on YouTube, that mm-hmm. gets stale after a while. And one of the guys I was working with, and continuing to work with, John Van Donk, sort of came up with this other protocol, this other method by which people could sort of bring to the room whatever they wanted to bring to the room. And the group, and as a group, once people would sort of bid, say, this is something that I've been thinking about, they'd sort of offer that to the group, and everyone would sort of offer something to the group. And what happened is that the group would begin to start to stitch something together. Mm-hmm. And once that process started, complete strangers having very little in common could come into a room, and within a relatively short amount of time, they would begin to have a satisfying and enjoyable conversation sufficient that they would come back again next month or next week to do it again. And so last summer when John and I went to Europe, one of the things that we decided to do was we sort of threw up on our calendar, especially in the UK, and said, if you want us to come, let us know and we'll come and we'll just run through an estuary group with you. And we did this night after night and city after city with very different groups of people. And it always worked. And this just really surprised me, because I've got a lot of experience running small groups as a pastor, running Bible studies, running prayer meetings, running mm-hmm. all sorts of things. I mean, that's what you mm-hmm. do as a pastor. You're always running these little groups of various sizes. And I was just really amazed at the desire for this that's out there in the world, that I think individualism and isolation has left people hungry mm-hmm. for connection. And then I was quite surprised at how fruitful these conversations, how people, I mean, it was the people themselves after they had the conversation said, wow. And they might be sort of hard pressed to tell you exactly what they got out of it, exactly what they received, but they very clearly felt they had received something of value mm-hmm. and sufficient that they'll probably spend another night, midweek night, and come out and do it again. So
if I may yeah. ask you, because you said as a pastor you used to do all kind of groupings.
Yes.
In that, and the way I understand you, in this group form, something different happened than you usually experience. And you also made the point, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. From your experience, what allows it to make it happen? What is it?
Well, in my experience, there we can certainly predict things that will kill it. Uh-huh. And those aren't too hard to spot. And so, and I find this to be very analogous to sort of when a worship service works and when it doesn't. There are certain things you can reliably do to impede it, but every time it happens, it's always a gift. And that's the emanation aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, that isn't to say that I haven't, you know, that I don't see this in worship services, that I don't see this in Bible studies. No, I do see it in those different forms. But what was unusual about this in terms of estuary, I always talk about it being church adjacent, in that mm-hmm. It's not a Bible study. There's no specific religious programming to this group process. People mm-hmm. are free to pitch whatever they want to the group, whatever they want to talk about. And as a pastor, I don't govern the group or put limits on it or anything. Now, there are potentially limits that things that I would put on, but sort of everybody's been sufficiently socialized that nobody's done anything really destructive or negative. But I again, I know things that will kill it, mm-hmm. but I do believe that when, in a sense, a blessing descends, we don't produce that.
Mm-hmm.
We can sort of, I mean, to me, it's sort of like gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like the practice of medicine. Doctors don't actually heal people. Doctors usually take away some of the things that are preventing healing from happening. No mm-hmm. gardener makes the plants grow.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you might fertilize, you might weed, you might cultivate, you might water.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all things that are sort of, and to me, this is exactly what pastoring is like too.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make it happen. And often one of the ways to kill it mm-hmm. is to work too hard to try to make it happen.
Yeah.
I am always, and part of this is my religious tradition as well, because Calvinism is a tradition in which it is all about receipt. We cannot earn our salvation. Salvation is always a gift. And so in setting up the group, you do what you can to create the situation. In some words, some people in Christian terms will say, you do what you can to build the altar.
Mm-hmm.
But like with Elijah and Carmel, fire has to come from heaven.
Yeah.
And if fire doesn't come, then you continue to pray.
But as I understand you, when you were talking about emanation, the way I translated it for me is also grace.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you cannot create grace,
right.
but there are graceful moments, and part of graceful moments, at least most of the time, is also that you're open for grace.
Yeah.
And what I experience in gatherings like this is something of this openness, which has, I would say, a lot to do with not knowing, with genuine curiosity, and also an openness that's be also seen as gratefulness for the moment. In that, and again, this is nothing that can produce this. And the very way that you're describing it, as soon as you try to do this as a kind of a book how to do it, you can be sure that you destroy it. But there is something where our innocence is needed to come together in this way. And I also hear you, and I really find this remarkable that this happens in not explicitly religious contexts where now we are going to mass or something like that.
Yeah.
But and there are people, you said this sooner, people who usually don't use a religious language are likely to use it all of a sudden because yeah. it feels applicable.
Yeah. And I think, I know some of the Christians are going to listen to this and some things that I always make some Christians nervous in certain ways, even though I myself, I'm an Orthodox Christian in that I believe in the resurrection of Jesus. I say the Apostles' Creed without any hesitation at all. But I see these dynamics true all throughout the world, all throughout the various aspects of life. Look at, let's say again, what it takes to make a good marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, there are certainly things that you can do to strengthen your marriage. There are things you can do to kill your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably do both in your lifetime, but in any given marriage, if it's long enough. But to the degree that, let's say, a really good marriage happens, there's always the sense of gift, of grace, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of marriage of religious persons, and that's true of marriage of persons who never go to church or never think or do anything that they would identify as religious.
Yeah.
And that's true of so many aspects of life, that this dynamic of, well, you can kill it. I mean, that's sort of Evil is available to you if that's what you'd like to wield. Or you can sort of set the stage for having the best, you know, the best circumstance. But whenever grace happens, it's always a gift. And that's, I think learning that as human beings is sort of basic wisdom for human beings, that you can't really make it happen when it is that je ne sais quoi, that thing that, and that's, of course, that's very connected to when we're using sacred as sort of an abstraction. Mm-hmm. That moment of Charles Taylor in The Secular Age calls it fullness. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the doctrine of common grace and Dutch Calvinism, people are graced throughout the world. C.S. Lewis makes this point, you know, often that, you know, people are graced with the birth of a child, with a happy marriage, with a joyful job prospect, with, I mean, God scatters his goodness broadcast throughout the world. And because that's a token of his generosity rather than our sufficiency.
Yeah. And again, to use this for the challenge of the open society, that is very important for me, and to use your image of the marriage, is there a possibility of the marriage of cultures where this kind of gift is possible between us in recognition also of our differences? Because I really appreciate you standing in your Calvinist tradition. And to be honest, I partly also envy you because I see the strength of that, and a strength that I don't have in that sense, because I am more in a fragile, rather independent. There's advantage to this too, but I can see the strength of tradition, let's put it that way. But I also see the necessity how Christians and devout Muslims can meet in their respective understanding of the sacred, not losing themselves, but finding each other at the same time. And for that, we need a language that also goes beyond the traditions, so that that the tradition can also talk beyond themselves. That's part of also how I understand John Rake's work. And why I appreciate it, so that because it connects. That's not in competition to the traditional language. I think that needs to be developed and sent, but we need something where the multiplicity can meet.
Yes, and again, this is where I see this is a function of pluralism. This is a function of globalization that we have been in the process of for a very long time. And I think in that sense, the liminal spaces between cultures have always been with us. Mm-hmm. And humans have always had to work these in-between spaces between cultures and traditions and religions and groups. Now we are sort of awash in them. For a whole variety of historic and technological reasons. And as you say, to do so with respect, but also to do so, I mean, I sometimes get the sense from people that any two people getting married are going to have a lot of sorting to do if they're going to share a household. And both of them come with their own cultures. Both of them come with their own families of origin. Both of them come with strengths and weaknesses. Both of them come with good and bad. And it's, I think, helpful to figure out what living together means is finding a way to do this sorting and negotiating Because some of the things I bring into the household, and I, you know, experience this as I often tell people, I never learned how selfish I was until I got married. Because my wife very much showed me how selfish I was in some respects. And then we both learned we didn't know how selfish we were until we started having children. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that 1 month old baby or that newborn baby that you bring home from the hospital, you can sit here and tell that baby, well, you know, the doctor says I should have 8 hours of sleep. That crying child is not going to care how many hours of sleep I need. The baby's just a bundle of need. And so part of this, part of this process is it's tremendously, it's challenging. It's an achievement. It's nuanced, but it's very much dealing with each other with respect, but it's also a process of influence, negotiation, compromise. And, you know, I think this is very much what we're seeing, let's say, in the political realm, as, you know, Europe is obviously having to deal with ongoing immigration from Africa, the Middle East, you know, so you have a continent with already sort of segmented religious traditions, but all within sort of Latin Christendom, now dealing with Islam, African cultures. And I mean, it's a tremendously challenging thing that we find. And I think modern secularism wanted to suggest that, well, if we just keep it about business and law, then we can sort of, religion will be on the sideline. And I think as the further we get into this, we see that, no, there's actually, and I think, again, the work of John Vervaeke has been really helpful with this to me, there's combinatorial explosiveness in terms of my formation. Mm-hmm. All of the stuff that I bring to the table is from this history, are from these various traditions that are within me and that have been formed and carried on almost unconsciously. I often talk about the fact that, you know, we all receive from our parents a first draft of the world, of the map of the world. And, you know, you have your household of origin that you grow up into. And then, you know, you discover these other maps from maybe some of the other people in your church and community. And then you discover other maps. First, you read about them in books. And now we discover them in that person, they go to a mosque. Oh, well, that is, what is that about? Well, there's the Bible and Abraham and those. So there's some continuity, but, and the mapping that has happened in the world has just gotten so massive. And on all of our maps, I grew up with wonderful parents. I had a great childhood, but there's stuff I brought into my marriage from my childhood that needed to be sorted out. My ego was attached to some of these things. I had to work that through. And these things all scale. And so I think part of what, you know, especially with estuary, that I look for, people often have questions. Well, why as a minister would you do this? Is this an evangelism program? And I'll say, well, not really. If you understand evangelism as, well, here, I'm going to try to convince you of all these propositions. I don't do any of that in an estuary group. But I think deeply as a Christian, you know, I think actually the, Jesus' biggest evangelistic mandate is not at the end of Matthew, what is sometimes called the Great Commission, go and make disciples. I think it's actually at the beginning of the book of Acts when Jesus says, you know, you go to these places and you will be my witness. And witness just puts you in a different posture from disciple making. And so what I do at estuary isn't exactly disciple making and how everybody thinks about it, but there is witness thing in the sense that I listen, I'm open, mm-hmm. I'm honest. And if I can model that, and if all of us come together with the openness and the listening and the honesty, there will be influence. And I think actually it's more influential than if I front load my propositional cannon and fire it at you.
And also, I honor and respect both parts of what you're talking, because missionary is maybe not the word evangelist that I would use, but our traditions need also to grow and flourish in their own. This is one dimension that I think is important, because they only can give what they can give if they are healthy in the life.
Yeah, yeah.
But then what they can give can go beyond themselves.
Yeah.
And can be, in that sense, Christ, what you are talking, which is, you also could name it in a different way, not in the Christian tradition, but you meet there and you give that. And the wisdom that comes from this tradition is independent of the name that this tradition gives to this wisdom. But both sides are important and need to be honored in that sense.
And I think, you know, I think it's sometimes hard for people to recognize that this tradition is both a noun, but it's also a process.
Uh-huh.
And you can't understand Christianity today apart from, you obviously had, you know, the Jews, you know, the Hebrews, and then the Jews, and then Jesus, but then also the Roman Empire and the Greeks, and then as it gets into Europe, you know, it's the impact of the Scandinavians and the Germanic peoples on Christianity, and traditions are very dynamic things, and they're like people. They're like us in that I am, you know, when I was born, I was 9 pounds, 21 inches long. And they gave me a name. And so, you know, that name sticks with me, and I am still that baby that my mother brought into this world, but, you know, I'm a whole lot bigger. And I'm a whole lot more complex, and traditions are like that too. They need to. It's a rather remarkable thing to think about, because on one hand they need narrative cohesion, they need a narrative thread, they need identity, but they also need to be living. And so they take in and they borrow and they adapt and they adopt and they influence. And so it's I think what we do in these conversations is in fact the work of tradition. Because I will, to a degree, because of my place within my tradition and within my church and denomination, the work that I do outside of it on the internet and in estuary comes into the Christian Reformed Church and the denomination. And the work that they have put into me goes out into the estuary, and on and on and on. And I think that's true of all of us. I would imagine that. I mean, before we started recording, we mentioned the fact that the church, you know, the church bells, you hear them in your town, and that formation. You mentioned too that this massive altar, that, you know, years of your life and very important years of your mappings, mm-hmm. that massive altar imprinted something on you, and whereas now, you might not be a Catholic in the way that you were as a child, some of that Catholicism will never leave you till your dying day.
Yeah. No, I'm very conscious of that. Whatever I am, it stands on the ground of my Catholic upbringing.
Yeah.
If I would be now a Buddhist or something, I wouldn't be a Buddhist. I would be a Catholic Buddhist. And it has to be honored. Otherwise, I don't honor myself.
Yeah.
And interesting what you're describing, because what came to my mind is that maybe part of a new tradition that we are forming right now that also has to do with technology, that we can have conversations like this, and this is networking like this, is creating, in honoring all the traditions, an ecology of practices that creates a new form of mutuality. And we need to find out how this can work so that everyone can also stand on its ownness and grow it at the same time. But there's something happening in what you and John and others call this corner of the internet particular, but not only there, where something, there's a new culture born in this. And we don't really know what this birth process is about. It's an ongoing finding out, but I have no doubt that this in itself is a new form of tradition, also in relationship to the sacred. Yeah. And how we as a world culture in all differences can relate to that, because secularism itself cannot do that.
Yeah. I think that's, well, I actually, you know, it's funny, my journey with respect to thinking about this word secular has continued for me in this process, because in looking at the work of Tom Holland, a writer, a history writer out of the UK, I think in many ways, Tom Holland's argument is that secular was sort of a certain, you might argue, might be a reduction, but a certain form of, it very much grows out of Christianity. And it very much grows out of this colonialism and this globalism to try to create an ecology of practices that would help pluralism not devolve into open warfare. Secularism in some ways created a standard in the way that, you know, the internet, HTTP, we no longer, our browsers are sophisticated, so we just type in www or amazon.com or something like this. But if you look at your browser, it always says HTTP, hyperlink transfer protocol, or maybe secure, put the S on the end, but that's a standard. And what the standard afforded was that, well, then nations could have domains, and it basically afforded connection over the internet. And I think what through colonization, through globalization, it's funny because on one hand, people hear colonization as a negative and globalization as a positive. Some hear globalization as a negative, but all of these terms are very connected, are interesting. But secularism in some ways tried to, and of course it had its good side and its downside, but basically tried to say, okay, so I've got Jesus and you've got Allah and they have Buddha and they have Ganesh, and these people don't say they don't have anyone, and these are talking to the Great Spirit, but there's a protocol, there's an ecology of practices by which we can not go to war over these things. And we can do some things. We can maybe trade. We can maybe talk. We can maybe share books. We can maybe share experiences. We can maybe learn each other's languages and have conversations. And secularity was in some ways a facilitation of this. Now, secularity, especially in conservative religious circles like mine, is often used as a negative. But there, again, just like many of the things that have worked strongly in our world, there's usually some of both in there. And so I think that the part that now with the recession of modernity, where we're going to see the recession of secularity of the same standard protocol, we're both going to see where, oh yeah, Hagia Sophia was a museum, which was a very secular thing, and now it's going to be a mosque again. Oh, okay. So in one sense, it's going to be, well, it was a church and then a mosque and then a museum and now a mosque. And so we're watching these permutations in world culture happen. Mm-hmm. And in some senses, to go into it as a mosque, well, that's one thing. To go into mm-hmm. it as a museum, well, that's very modern, secular. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to have these experiences all over the place as, you know, the global context continues to change and evolve.
It's cool also the way you're contextualizing the secular as being also a mode to try to live the good, the true, and the beautiful together.
Yeah.
But see, interesting also coming from Germany, the secular age is very much related to a German experience, which is the Peace of Westphalia, which was the 30 Years' War.
Yes.
Which reduced the German population by 30% out of the religious war. Basically, Germany was devastated after 30 years. And in the end, it was a stalemate where they said, we cannot solve this conflict, Catholic or Protestant. We separate the church sphere and the secular sphere and try to live together.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it was exactly what you're describing. It was out of devastation after 30 years of destroying Europe, an attempt to find a way to live together in a way that allows the people to also live their relationship to sacred. That created something that also had a shadow side, and we very much dealing with that, but it has to be also honored. Yeah. That the impulse in the beginning had was something very positive at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's amazing to me how it's very interesting to me how in some ways you can look at the 30 Years' War as it's a key moment in the beginning of modernity and modern liberalism in terms of this differentiation that we had of the secular and the religious. That's a big moment in that. And now how, as we're sort of at the recession of this, we're saying, oh yeah, let's not forget the 30 Years' War. Let's not forget in this moment where we don't really want to, for all of, in some ways, I think the people are looking at the Middle Ages, the medieval period, and reassessing it now. We also should remember that during the medieval period, that's also the period of the Crusades, where the fundamental difference was, let's say, between Christian and Islam. And whereas that's still a difference, and it's still a difference we will continue to talk about and we will continue to discuss. What we don't want to do is just have, you know, the same kinds of wars and never-ending wars. And of course, even though we've had wars over Islamism and a bunch of things recently. So in other words, the lessons of the 30 Years' War and some of the fruits of it still bear, we should continue to pay attention to them. So,
yeah.
Anything, I have to land the plane on this because I have a puppy to raise, at least for a little while yet. Tell me a little bit about this magazine that you have and what exactly the program that you're doing now involves.
The program is very much this emergent interbeing training that I shortly touched on. The magazine is a magazine that I run here since 15 years in this incarnation and before, where we bring our conversations of our the culture of our times in a dialogue between science and spirituality in a way where we try to really create a dialogical approach that kind of has an imprint and culture that honors both sides at the same time. And it's a quarterly magazine, so we always have a lot of time, although it doesn't seem so, to really create a constellation where we try to find an integration of the secular and the post-secular.
All right. And the name of the magazine is?
Evolve.
Evolve. And it's in German, German language magazine?
It's in German only, but we're in the process of opening a website where all our articles will be also translated online in English.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good. Yeah, that's part of this. You know, I wish I could speak German with you. I just don't know any. We could probably maybe do it in Spanish, but I imagine that I know that my English is definitely better than my Spanish, and that's often true for many. English has become a language of international conversation, at least.
No, but I really appreciate this conversation, and also these forms of meetings that you are creating, because I think that is what is needed right now, and I'm very much looking forward to meet you in person there and have this conversation in person. And I'm also very much looking in maybe a couple of weeks to have the conversation where I'm really interested to find out how you do this also with your background in your tradition, but also kind of this orientation that goes beyond your tradition in the way I understand your work. So I'm very much forward to kind of hear more about this.
All right. No, I'm looking forward to all of that too. And we will be, I should probably, in fairness to our those who are hosting the meeting, the links to register for the Breakwater Festival in Germany, they're beneath all of my videos. They have been for a couple of months. The meeting, actually, I will fly into Germany the last full week in October. It's that last weekend in October that we will have the festival. And there'll be some more videos coming up where Thomas and I will speak again, and then we'll bring in Andrea and Cassidy and Matthias. And so the conversation will grow, and I'm very much looking forward to this. So thank you very much. I'll just end the recording now, and then maybe we'll see if we can at least put a tentative date to do our next recording.
Great. Thank you.